Greetings and welcome to the Cerebral Women Art Talks podcast. I'm Phyllis Hollis, your host. As an extension of my Instagram page, Cerebral Women, this podcast offers insights into the visual art world. I interview artists, mainly artists of color and female artists, who will freely articulate what inspires their creativity. In addition, you'll hear interesting perspectives from dedicated art professionals who work with artists and the art institutions that feature them. I'm confident that collectively, these individuals will indeed stimulate your mind as they do our eyes. Please know these interviews are conducted in my Manhattan apartment, so please forgive the background sounds of city life. Welcome to the Cerebral Women Art Talks podcast. This episode features leading contemporary art curator Connie Butler, the director of MoMA PS1 in New York. Prior to her arrival in the fall of 2023, Connie was chief curator at the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles, where she organized numerous exhibitions, including the Biennial of Los Angeles Artists, Made in LA in 2014, Mark Bradford, Scorched Earth, 2015, Marissa Mers, The Sky is a Great Place, in 2017, Larry Pittman, Declaration of Independence in 2019, and Witch Hunt in 2021. She also co-organized with MoMA, Adrian Piper, a synthesis of institutions which opened at the Hammer in October of 2018. From 2006 to 2013, she was the Robert Lehman Foundation Chief Curator of Drawings at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. Connie also organized the groundbreaking survey WAC, Art and the Feminist Revolution, in 2007 at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles, where she was curator from 1996 to 2006. In 2020, Connie received the Bard College Audrey Irmas Award for Curatorial Excellence. Please visit cerebralwomen.com for her expanded bio and enjoy this episode featuring the current director of MoMA PS1, Connie Butler. Connie, welcome to my podcast. I'm delighted to have you today.
Thank you, Phyllis. Very happy to be here.
When in your life did you recognize your love of the visual arts?
When I was in high school, I took an art history class. I was at that early time in my life, I was also a dancer and getting involved in choreography and performance. So I was involved with the making of art, but then I also started to study art history. And I had the privilege of going on a trip to Europe at that time to see some of the great art historical sites of Western art. And I fell in love with it at that time. You know, a wonderful early teacher is always a key and a portal to new worlds, potentially. And my art history teacher at that time was that. So then as I moved into my undergraduate studies and was still involved with dance, I've always thought that was very important because it taught me a lot about process and about what it means to be in the studio and to create, even if it was from a movement and performance perspective. But then as I went through my studies at university, I just kept pursuing art history and literature and other things, but really focusing in on art history, and did an undergraduate thesis at that time on the role of artists with art institutions and the history of that. The relationship between artists and museums actually was kind of my first research project that was part of an undergraduate thesis. So from very early on, I kind of fell in love with art history and knew that I wanted to work with living artists and didn't really look back from there. That was it for me.
Looking back, do you ever think about what other career path you would have chosen if you hadn't had this experience in your art classes?
You know, I love what I do and I feel very lucky that I still enjoy coming to work every day at the different institutions that I've had the privilege to work for. But I will say, you know, in recent years, as our field is going through so much kind of turmoil, and in many ways, these jobs have become very difficult, I have for the first time thought about, you know, what if I had done something else, and what would that be? You know, for many years when I was young, as I said, thought about being a dancer, but I think I didn't want it badly enough. And I've always thought that art history was sort of, if you can't make art, then you can at least support it and provide a platform for it, which is very much what I think that I do. You know, I have thought about over the years, journalism, which I think is a fascinating field, although a very contentious one at the moment. But, you know, the value of good journalism can't be overstated, I think. That's always been of interest to me. Yeah, there aren't too many other things I think I'm good for. So I continue on, devoted to the museum field.
What do you feel is the purpose of art?
I really believe that it's through artists and through art that we can see the world differently. And I think art and the experience of art can be life-changing. I really believe that. I think it's up to museums to continue to keep up with art practice and to provide a platform for art because of that. I think that art and artists are, you know, some of our greatest treasures culturally. And although we don't do as good a job of valuing them in this country as you know, in Europe and other places in the world, I continue to think that artists give us a lens onto the political and social issues of our time, and I think are critical to how we move through the world.
What type of relationship do you like to have with artists?
For me, it's really always been about discourse, and artists are some of my closest friends, my primary relationships. So I really value a kind of wide net of artists, actually, some of whom I'm in dialogue with almost every day and others who I speak to more intermittently, but who really have shaped my thinking over time. And I feel like as a curator, which is what I have primarily been in this field until now, that all of my ideas for exhibitions, even for acquisitions, really are shaped by being in dialogue with artists, that no good exhibition happens without the input at some point of an artist or a group of artists. It's really important to how I think as a curator. And, you know, I think those of us who are overseeing exhibition programs and in charge of that, to make a good program, you need to know what artists are thinking about, what are the urgent issues of our day, how can we respond very much in real time to what's going on in our world. And all of that, to me, artists are really key in identifying what those issues are and identifying really how we should proceed with these programs that we make.
When you're overseeing an exhibition, how deeply do you think about the audience? You know, who is going to be coming into the museum to view what you have allowed or directed your curators to orchestrate, to design?
Well, this is such a key question, Phyllis. I mean, and one that I think has changed a lot in the field over time, particularly in the contemporary art area. I mean, when I started out, I can honestly say, I think museums were thinking very little about their audiences, contemporary art museums. You know, there was this ethos of if you build it, they will come. You know, that if you just put art on the walls, that it speaks for itself, that the audience will come, that you don't actually have to give them anything when they come except the art itself, that the art would somehow immediately be accessible and offer a transcendent experience. Well, over time, you know, and over the intervening decades, the last few decades, we certainly have learned very important lessons about the barriers that museums have to audience, you know, many different kinds of audiences, whether it's class or cultural or racial, gender-based, you know, all of these biases that are inherent within institutions that create bias and barriers of different kinds for audiences. And so I would say that while artists, for me, are my own personal first audience and first sounding board, there's no question that I try to think deeply about, within an overall program, are there things for many different kinds of publics and for diverse audiences? I think that we have to do a better job in the field of making what we do accessible for audiences, whether that's putting art on the wall that people can see themselves in, or whether that is addressing, you know, as I said, the many different ways that institutions, that there are barriers, whether it's, you know, an entry price, whether it's how you welcome them when they come to your museum. Do they feel comfortable? You know, many people are very intimidated by what happens in a museum. They don't feel that it's for them. So how can we change that? And at the same time, educate them about things they may not know or perspectives they may not have considered. But most importantly, how do we make them feel welcome in our spaces? And I do think we are all thinking about that now much differently than we were even a decade ago.
In your opinion, what is the significance of art fairs?
Well, since I know we both just came from the Freeze Art Fair in Los Angeles, I think art fairs have become part of our world. I mean, I can barely remember an art world without them, although I do remember in the late 1990s, I guess it was, when the Armory Show emerged, the Gramercy Park Art Fair, all of these different, you know, the small hotel fairs, the bigger fairs, when all of it started. I think it changed on the commercial side. It changed radically how art is consumed and acquired by collectors and sort of the donor class. I mean, I think it became something, and I hear this from dealers all the time, where people kind of prefer almost to buy at art fairs or from PDFs as part of this kind of global circulation of art rather than in the bricks and mortar gallery spaces themselves, which I think has led to a lot of questioning. And I think there's a bit of a return now, actually, to brick and mortar spaces, to people really being excited about seeing exhibitions in real time and space within galleries. But the art fairs have really fostered a different way of collecting, a much more voracious way of collecting contemporary art, you know, a very competitive way. They've also created, I think, to some degree, a kind of homogenization of collecting, you know, although that's changing too. But, you know, these collecting patterns where you end up with everybody running after the same 12 artists to represent them in their collection. But, you know, I think they've been very important for the collecting class. I increasingly feel like art fairs don't have very much to do or have less and less to do with what we actually do at the museum, broadly speaking. I mean, I go to art fairs because it's a great place to see colleagues and friends and collectors and experience art with people. But I don't really believe that museums should be, very infrequently do they purchase art from art fairs. I think that's something that, you know, it's not really for us. I think we're there as kind of the social, the social glue, I suppose. But the art fairs really are for private collectors first and foremost. And I think the art fairs themselves have done a lot in recent years to reach out to broader audiences. They certainly are trying to expand, you know, the collector base and make themselves more accessible too. So I think they have value. I think they do. I think that there are way too many of them. Yes. I think that, I'm in awe of my gallery colleagues who do, you know, 4, 5, 6 fairs a year. I think that's quite a heavy lift. It's also very intense for artists who often feel like they have to produce for these fairs. And I think that leads to a kind of dilution of art production. I mean, it's just, you know, art produced for art fairs is not the best art. So I think there are too many of them. I thought that coming out of COVID, we might see the number of global fairs kind of drop off a bit. And in fact, it hasn't very much. You know, they're just shifting to new markets. And you know, we see the growth of fairs in Korea and Hong Kong and in the Asian market, and that's super interesting. But they're not exactly slowing down. So I don't know what to think of that. We'll all just keep going to them. I mean, I am concerned with the kind of problematic environmental footprint of art fairs. And of course, there's a strong collective of dealers who are talking about that, how to make them more sustainable. And I think that's really important because certainly the footprint of everybody jumping on planes and running around to look at art is not great environmentally. But so I hope that conversation continues. But like so many things after the pandemic, we seem to be back to business as usual. So as long as the demand is there, the art fairs will continue to happen.
And for the artist's sake, it's great the demand is there. But yes, in every other way. It is a little bit much.
Well, it is. Yeah, I mean, certainly there. It's been great to see so many artists benefiting from the success of the art fairs. But really, you know, the percentages are such that it still benefits a very, you know, a sort of top level of artist and is less accessible to kind of so many other artists who are working.
How would you compare the role of the collector versus the art patron?
Well, I love that you asked that question because art patronage is so important. I mean, you know, you're involved with the Black Arts Council at the Museum of Modern Art, which is such an important group and supports exhibitions and acquisitions. And I think that patronage of that kind that really develops a program over time with a museum and supports the development of a program or of a group of artists or is so important. You know, a collector doesn't have to be a patron. A private collector collects many of them and maybe even the majority of them collect for themselves. You know, they have a passion. They want to build something of their own in terms of a collection. They want art to live with and for their home. And, you know, thank goodness for that because they are certainly supporting artists and galleries as they do that. But patronage is another step. And when someone chooses to get involved with a museum or an institution, that is such important support because it makes a link to the commercial world. It makes a link to the support for artists. And that, you know, the philanthropic model in this country is dependent on patronage. It really is. It's dependent on donors and patrons. And, you know, we see this model being adapted more in Europe and in other places, but the American philanthropic model is not possible without very generous donors and patrons. And, you know, there's a lot of talk in the field about how perhaps that model needs to change. And I think it does need to certainly open up who can serve on boards, you know, with perhaps not such a high barrier of entry. And as we all want to diversify who sits in governance roles at our museums, I think we need to think more creatively about that. But patronage is extremely important. And, you know, I hope that, you know, the young collectors in the music industry, in Hollywood, in the tech industry, and some of these emerging industries will continue that kind of patronage. I mean, and I don't know. I mean, we're experiencing a big shift between an older generation of patron who have sat on these museum boards to now a younger generation. And it's a big shift, you know, to see who's going to pick up the mantle of patronage.
On the topic of boards, what do you feel is the most important role of the museum trustee? How can they help bring about change?
Well, I've been so lucky to work with really extraordinary trustees and patrons over the years. And the best, I would say, and most fruitful relationships are with the kind of trustee who understands the sort of the line between what they do and what we do at the museum and what the curators do, that they don't want to influence the program, but they want to support the program because they believe in the organization and its mission kind of longer term. I mean, I'm really lucky at the moment to work with an extraordinary board chair who also happens to be a younger generation patron, Sarah Arison. And she and others I can think of really enlightened because they believe in the mission of the place. They believe in the bigger picture. They want to support institutional stability going forward into the future, but they do not get involved in the weeds of the staff and the curatorial mission of the institution. And that's really the ideal situation that you want. You know, that said, is it really fun to talk to your trustees about art? Do you want them engaged conceptually and to be telling you about what they see and what they collect? Absolutely. You know, you want a really healthy kind of conversation about art and about the mission of your institution, no question. And that's incumbent on us, the curators, the directors, to cultivate that. I mean, that's part of the fun part, is both educating them, but also listening to them about what they're seeing and what they're thinking, because they're always involved in different industries and, you know, see a ton and very sophisticated people and have access that we don't always have. So it's a back and forth. But I would say, for me, that line in the sand is really about a sort of enlightened institutional support that leaves the curatorial decisions and the kind of administrative decisions and so on to the staff.
How do you feel the Black Lives Matters movement impacted the cultural mission of art institutions?
That's such an important question about Black Lives Matter. And I think we are still, honestly, we are still internalizing and processing what that meant. I know I am. I was at the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles when, you know, during the pandemic and during the Black Lives Matter movement, and participated, you know, in a lot of the protests, actually, and was really profoundly moved by that experience and felt really urgently and wanting to, you know, be an ally and be out there, which I was. It was very complicated for our institution, as it was for many institutions, to try to figure out about how to message support for Black Lives Matter. You know, is it the museum's role to publicly broadcast support for this issue? Because then that opens you up, you know, do you then have to support or want to support? What about other issues? You know, is it our role to every time be gesturing to the public, to be signaling to the public that we're in support of Black Lives Matter or whatever the issue of the day might be? But I feel that, so those conversations were complicated. And I think because of social media and because of the sort of perfect storm of Black Lives Matter with then the pandemic and everyone being isolated at home and all of this, thinking about how to respond was very particular, right, to that particular moment. But I think that there's no question that all of that and what we went through and the racial reckoning that we went through has profoundly impacted the museum field, as it has the humanities and academia and beyond. And I think what you've seen in the museum field is, in a relatively short period of time, museums kind of radically changing how they do business in terms of, if you weren't already showing BIPOC and a diverse slate of artists on your walls, you needed to start doing that very quickly. Many of us had been doing that work for a long time, and I'm proud to say that, you know, at the Hammer Museum, I think our outward-facing program was already quite diverse, but for a lot of museums, that wasn't the case. And so it was a radicalizing moment in that way. But I think even longer term, how we think about governance, you know, who is on our board of trustees? Does your board represent a diversity of opinions, a diversity of backgrounds, fields that people are involved in, all of that? I think we are now thinking about in a different way than we were even 5 years ago. And a lot of that is because of Black Lives Matter. And certainly the work that we're doing on the inside at PS1, at places like the Hammer, at so many museums around the country, the DEI work that we are doing, the plan that we have, the conversations that we have about how to address systemic problems within our institutions, whether it's systemic racism or gender bias or whatever it is. But so many of us are doing that in a much more concrete, intentional way, and that is hopefully impactful, than we were before Black Lives Matter. I mean, there's just no question. You know, I'm involved with a group called Museums Moving Forward that is now, I'm now sort of on the advisory group for that, and our work has become more public. But we started, it's a group of museum professionals working on both coasts and in the middle, who gathered together as part of the Me Too movement. So coming out of actually 2014 and thinking about gender inequity in museums. And when Black Lives Matter came, we completely overhauled our own mission and conversations to include equity across the board. So racial equity. And we were doing that, but again, it is now much more intentionally part of what Museum Moving Forward is doing and the work that was done. So I feel like BLM had a profound impact on art institutions and on their missions. I mean, you see museums really declaring social justice in a much more visible and forward kind of way than maybe they had been previously. And I think it radicalized us as individuals, but also as institutions. I feel that strongly, and I feel proud of it. I feel really proud of the work that I did at that time and the marches that I went to and the thinking that still continues to impact me.
So what are you excited about right now?
Well, I'm 5 months into a new position at one of the greatest contemporary art institutions in this country, I believe, MoMA PS1. And I'm very excited about its future. I think that the institution has come out of of COVID, of that time period, as so many institutions are, just getting back up on our feet. Our attendance is increasing. We are staffing back up. We are reemerging, I would say, with a terrific program. And it's been a terrific program. But thinking about how to tighten up what we're doing, how to tighten up our mission, to think about our mission, to bring in audience, and to really how to open up this place to a much broader audience than it has historically had, I'm very excited about, actually. We have an extraordinary campus here in Long Island City, in Queens, which, as you know, is the fastest growing and most diverse borough in the country. And we have started to do very good work that predates me to open up to Queens. But I think there are all kinds of things we can do, including changes and upgrades in our building. You know, we operate in this 19th century schoolhouse, which is an extraordinary piece of architecture and a very unique experience for visitors, but we need to update it in a lot of different ways to make our amenities more public, more welcoming. And I'm excited to do that while remaining an institution that's really guided by artists. And while we are very embedded with artists and thinking about how to produce work and new work. So all of that is super exciting. In a very concrete way, I'm very excited about what will be my first show here, much sooner than I thought. But, we program not so far ahead here at PS1. So in the fall, I'm doing a big project with the artist Ralph Lemon, who is best known as a choreographer and dancer and is an extraordinarily influential figure who came of age in the 1990s. But about 10 years ago, he moved from being a dancer with a company, a kind of official, structured, more commercial company, to being an artist who practices and makes drawings and videos and sculpture in addition to his dance-based works, his movement-based works. And he's someone who really works with an incredible community of artists like Kevin Beasley and Akwi Okpashvili and many others to realize his work. So I feel like the show will tap into really a community of, rock stars, of incredible artists based here in New York. So we will, I think, appeal to our local audience, but it will really survey a career of a polymathic artist who I find extraordinary. I think Ralph, for me, is one of our most important living artists. So I'm super excited about that show and what he's going to do. There will be also a robust program of live works over the course of the exhibition. So dance-based works too in our space. And PS1 has a really wonderful history of dance over the years. So I'm kind of excited to build on that and think about carrying that forward.
This has been an enjoyable conversation. So this is our last question. And you've sort of touched on it already, but I'll ask again. So in your current role, how do you want to impact the art world?
Because I'm new and very optimistic and full of energy, I'm thinking big, right? So Glenn Lowry, the director of MoMA, said to me recently that he believes that between MoMA and PS1, that we have potentially the most impactful platform for contemporary art in the country and maybe beyond. And I really feel that about PS1, I think we have increasingly something very unique to offer the art world, the art visitor, the many publics that we want to serve. I think we can offer a unique experience of architecture. We can respond to artists in real time, which I think is something we do really well here. We don't work on things 5 years out. We're working on things a year out and really responding to what we see and to what artists are thinking about. So I think that's a rare thing, and I think being truly guided by artists, a lot of museums talk about that, but I think we actually do it. So I'm very excited to just get the New York audience back, get people coming here again. One of our catchphrases is that we're trying out at the moment is producing on all stages, which I think is what PS1 does. I think our talks program, our performances, what we do with music and warm up in the summer, all of our exhibitions are about really creating kind of knowledge and scholarship and contemporary discourse in real time. And I think we are positioned to do that, dare I say, better than anyone else in the city at our best. So that's my goal, and that's how I think we can be really impactful in this very complicated ecosystem that we are in New York City.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Phyllis. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Cerebral Women Art Talks podcast. For additional content, please visit cerebralwomen.com and be sure to follow Cerebral Women on Instagram.